Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This episode of our podcast contains quite a bit of adult language from Bette Midler.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Yes, officer. I know what I did, and I know why that man pressed charges. Oh, my God. I can't believe I'm here.
In the new film Coastal Elites, Bette Midler plays a New Yorker of a certain type. A retired teacher who lives on the Upper West Side, reads the New York Times with Talmudic attention, and is driven insane by Donald Trump. So much so that one day she picks a fight in a coffee shop with a guy who's wearing a red MAGA hat.
I snapped. I lost it. I went full on Worldwide Wrestling Federation, Navy SEAL, Jason Bourne, Goy, and I grabbed that hat. I'm going to throw it on the ground, but he grabs my arm and he's twisting it. He says, "That's my hat, bitch." I said, "Not today, asshole." And I yank my arm away, but I keep the hat and I run.
That's Bette Midler performing in Paul Rudnick's Coastal Elites. In real life, Midler herself has gotten into some Trump-related trouble. After we spoke, she tweeted some ill-advised comments about Melania Trump's accent, which she later apologized for. Paul Rudnick wrote Coastal Elites as a series of monologues to be performed on stage, but with the pandemic, it was reconceived as a film for HBO. I talked recently with Paul Rudnick and Bette Midler.
Bette, I spent, I don't mind telling you, a small fortune, but never regretted it, to sit in the second row to watch you do Hello, Dolly.
I have always been a woman who arranges things for the pleasure and the profit it derives. I have always been a woman who arranges things like furniture, daffodils, and lives.
And one of the things I was thinking about after those performances is the tremendous energy you must get from the audience, that it goes back and forth. And here you're filming practically by yourself.
Oh no, I was alone in that room.
Right. So what is that experience like? It must be radically different.
It was fabulous.
Because you didn't have any pants on or something?
No. I was completely dressed in my little costume all the way down to my shoes. Even though I was cut off at the chest by the table in the jail. It's a matter of concentration. It was so easy to concentrate because you didn't have to turn and listen to anybody else. You were just looking in one spot and trying to convince someone that of the rightness of your cause. So the concentration was impeccable. I mean, it was one of the easiest gigs I've ever had because I didn't have to share the stage. Oh,
you don't have to share the stage, and nobody's crinkling candy wrappers in the third row or taking a cell phone shot.
Exactly. And I have to say, we had 2 days. We shot one day, like Friday, and then Saturday we came back and shot again. And I really did not get it until like the last take Saturday, because it's very slippery.
Because when you're shooting remotely, it's very distilled. You're not in a rehearsal room. There aren't distractions. There aren't hundreds of crew members. You have like the best possible seat in the house for a Bette Midler performance. So it was very exciting. And for this piece, because it's so intimate, that felt exactly right. You actually got closer than you would if it had been staged live in the theater. And you thought, oh my God, this is the way to work. So it was unexpected, but kind of a weird gift.
Paul, I read a part of Coastal Elites. It must be about a year ago, which now seems, of course, like 20 years ago. How do you write a piece that tries to catch up with the world where the world is just tumbling downhill faster and faster?
Well, I think the piece you read was actually the piece that Bette performs beyond superbly, because it was... this stuff was just pouring out of me. It was sort of after 4 years of Trump, the anxiety level everywhere and in everyone I knew had not dissipated at all. So it just became ridiculous not to write about this stuff. And what was exciting was that as the year went on, and originally these pieces were going to be staged live at the Public Theater with Jay Roach directing, and the pandemic shut that down. And then when I thought, okay, this is not happening, but then the HBO and our production team came up with the idea of shooting it remotely and putting, you know, every possible COVID protocol in place. And I also got to rewrite so I could keep up, so we could include material on the pandemic and on Black Lives Matter and how it would impact these characters' lives. And so that's very rare to be able to write that immediately.
Is it rough to write a comedy in real time when the tragic dimension is so immense?
Yes, of course. But and it's something that I learned many years ago when I wrote a play called Jeffrey that was also a movie, which was a romantic comedy of all things set in the era of the AIDS crisis, the peak of the crisis, because I thought disease and suffering are never funny, but people are. And I thought that's especially when you're dealing with a disease that has no cure and very little treatment, a sense of humor may be all you have left. And especially when you're dealing with New Yorkers, which is what I like to do, that you've got people for whom humor is just part of their first language. It's how they cope. And it's a glory. So it was, it wasn't something I added on top of the material. It seemed very organic.
Now, I got to tell you, Paul, you're now finished because I'm so excited to speak to Bette Midler that I may or may not come back to you.
Sweet of you. Oh, don't do that. Don't do that. I love to hear him talk. He's so passionate about this material and he's you know, I've been following this piece of material for a long, long time and he's so passionate. He has all the answers. He really does have all the answers.
Well, you play a character named Miriam Nestler, who's a retired public school teacher in New York, and she finds herself in police custody after a fight with a guy who's wearing a MAGA hat. How much did you identify with Miriam Nestler?
Oh, tremendously, except I don't live on the Upper West Side. I identified with her. You know, I have librarians in my family, and we're all kind of civic-minded, and we're very proud of what we call our culture. But I identified with her very, very strongly, and I think she's hilarious because she gives these little digs, and then she's just kidding. But the truth is that she's not kidding. You know, this means the whole world to her, and I think the fact that she's gone into physical battle as a warrior against this mental aberration is not just admirable. It's saintly. You know, she compares herself at the end of the piece to Joan of Arc, and she says, "In my way, in my small way, I too am a Joan of Arc because I was unafraid. I marched into battle to save what needs to be saved." I think she's kind of fabulous. I love her.
Now, how do you feel when you see a MAGA hat on the...
I can't look at them. I find it distressing because, well, it's like the masks. Why would anybody not wear a mask if you were going to protect your next door neighbor or your own family? It's like a gap in their consciousness. It makes no sense. Please, I'm worked up.
Do you ever think about how they see you? Do they see people who are...
I don't give a fuck. I'm sorry. I don't care how they see me. Occasionally, in the old days, I used to. And when, you know, when we first started tweeting, I used to get trolled and I used to think, oh, this isn't very nice. I don't feel good doing this. And then I thought to myself, well, maybe I shouldn't be so harsh on other people. But then when the other people turned out to be so insane, it's almost like, well, you just have to say something. You can't just let this slide by. This isn't behavior. This is abnormal, you know? At least pretend.
Pretend what?
Pretend what? Pretend to be a human being. You know, some of them, it's almost as if they have a shell, you know? Let's not go there. This is a dead end. Let's move on.
So,
Paul, you look fabulous. I'm so happy to see you.
What is your favorite bit of the monologue that we hear from Miriam Nestler?
Well, the character is very much a tribute to the women of my family, to my mom and her sisters especially. There was a absolute worship of education and information that I so appreciated. And it was a wonderful upbringing in that sense, that there was a reverence for culture, for theater, for museums, for reading, that these were the sacraments of their form of deeply reformed Judaism. And that's something I so admire about this woman. And she was also funny because she's insane. You know, there's the constant battle, which Bette captures so superbly, between wanting to understand the rest of the world, wanting there to be hope, wanting there to be beauty and agreement between people, and yet constantly battling with the dark side, with the fact that the rest of the world doesn't always see things that way.
So I'm at Starbucks, and I stand up, and I walk over, and I say to the guy, "So, the hat, why are you wearing it?" And he looks me up and down, and he smirks. And I know I shouldn't be judging, but show me one person who voted for that man who doesn't smirk. And he says, "I'm wearing it because it drives you fucking nuts." And I think to myself, well, he's not wrong. And then I say, "But why do you want to drive me fucking nuts?" And I say it clearly. I ask the question so the "you repulsive piece of racist shit" is silent.
When I heard Vet deliver that with such sort of pinpoint delicacy, where you got what the polar opposites that this character was sort of ping-ponging between, and it was just perfection. It was, yes, that's what we're all going through, is a desire to not shut down, to remain hopeful in the face of such total ignorance.
I love the piece about her husband. And I love the crumbs that Paul drops along the way about who he was with her, that he was a gym teacher, that he taught gym in public school, and that they used to spend all day Sunday reading the New York Times. And they called it and eating lox and raisin. We had a big fight about raisin bagels. Who would ever eat a raisin bagel? We had this huge fight, Paul
Excuse
and I.
Me.
And I said, an everything bagel, never, never a raisin bagel. Well, so raisin bagels it was.
Paul, I have to side with Bette here. Raisin bagel is not a bagel. It's cake.
Wait, but Paul is Paul is very interesting. You know, I read once that Thomas Edison only ate sweets. So I tried that for a while. Because, I mean, if it was good enough for Thomas Edison, it was certainly good enough for me. Well, Paul is like Thomas Edison. He really likes his sweets.
In many ways.
What?
In many ways.
Yes, look at all the things you've invented and the characters you've invented.
I think in many ways the pieces collectively are about the way Trump has driven people crazy. And it's probably true, Paul. Maybe I'm wrong, Bette. The people who are going to watch it on HBO, just as they would have seen it at the public theater had COVID not intervened, are pretty like-minded. My guess is that. And so what do you think it'll do for that audience as opposed to the audience that in some ways you're never going to reach?
Well,
the likelihood is.
I think that the you know, preaching to the choir, I think the people who are aware will tune into it, but I hope that other people will come out of curiosity and maybe have their consciousness shift even a little bit. I do have to say, I think this pandemic has shifted a lot of people. I really do. I think the handling, the utter lack of compassion and humanity and the complete disarray of a government. Well, we saw this in Katrina. Well, let's not fool ourselves. If we could remember back that far. I mean, that was a shit show too, you know, but nothing changed. We thought things changed, but apparently it only got worse as these agencies got hollowed out, right? So
now, you've actually feuded with Donald Trump on Twitter. He once called you, and you don't mind if I say this, he once called you
washed up psycho.
There you go. And what was the experience like of trading insults online?
Oh, he's revolting. He has, you know, he'll do anything. He'll do anything for his ratings. He'll do anything to keep his face. He doesn't, you know, who was it that said, without publicity, something terrible happens. And so the other person says, what? And he says, nothing. He's such a whore. He's such a publicity whore. He doesn't care if it's bad publicity.
Did you ever run into him in his life before
politics?
I went
to his house. I had dinner with him. Check this out. The office called and said it was Andre Leontali's birthday.
The fashion editor who was at Vogue for so many years.
Yeah. And would I and my husband and I come? And of course, I adore Andrei Leontali. Trump, not so much, because he's ridiculous. You know, he was just a buffoon. So I went, and we went to the tower, and it was just what you think. It's glitter. He had a strange little fountain in the middle of the living room, you know, with a dolphin. You know, those dolphins, those sea creatures spouting water. I'm like, what the fuck is this doing in the middle of the room? Anyway, so Andrei was there. This was the guest list. Andrei Leontali, my husband, me, Melania and Donald. That was the birthday party.
Sounds like heaven.
I kept saying, is anybody else coming? Is anyone else coming? Should we start?
I want to hear everything about this dinner.
He showed me Rockefeller Center. He showed me Radio City. Like, I never saw Radio City before. He says, isn't this a fabulous view? I'm saying, cement, mortar? I don't know. It's all right. So it's lit up. Yeah, it's nice. I mean, it's not like green. People, you know, if you sit on the park, you say, wow, now that's a view. Now, this was cement. This was towers. I'm not into towers. I like.
What did you talk about at dinner with Donald Trump?
I have no memory. I have absolutely no memory. No memory. But I adore Andrei. So listen, this is what I figured out. It took me 15, close to 20 years to figure out, what was I doing there? What were we doing there? And finally, it dawned on me. It was, he had his Melania, and he must have promised her she'd get on the cover of Vogue. And he was an editor. He was an editor at large at the time. So maybe he delivered me to Andrei. Andrei could have called me up. I would have gone anywhere with him. I adore him. You know, I love his work. I love his backstory. I love everything about him. So he didn't know that, but I told him that night. Never heard from him again. Anyway, but I still love him. I don't care. So that was my, and it was so bizarre, but it took me a long time to realize I was like a deliverable. I was like a bait. I was a bait and switch. You know, it's just transactional and appalling.
But it still must register as a deep sadness to both of you to know that there are all these theaters that are dark and we're not going to be back in them anytime soon, I don't think.
I cannot tell you how distressing it is. It's truly distressing because it's not just the landlords. I mean, of course, it's not the landlords. It's not just the actors. It's everybody who is connected to it. You know, the costumers who are struggling, the costume houses. There are 50 costume houses in New York City, and they hire hundreds of people all over the world to embroider, to bead. They're pattern makers, they're stitchers. I mean, fitters. I mean, hundreds of people are out of work and they have no hope. They have nothing coming in. And it's just awful. And then there's all the people in the Times Square area. A lot of those are mom and pop businesses. And they just all had to close their doors. So it's, you know, the stage hands and the musicians. And it's overwhelming.
What is the talk in the theater world about when this activity, this huge aspect of New York life will be revived?
They have not shared anything with me. I call from time to time, and I think they're trying to figure it out. But I mean, they've been trying to figure it out since March, and I can't really say that they haven't told me that they're making any headway.
No, there have been all sorts of attempts, some of them actually glorious, to do online theater, to do Zoom readings, to do Zoom presentations. But beyond that, there is a hope that I think sometime March or April that there will be a sense of return, that if there are therapeutics, if there is a possible vaccine, that it will be possible. I think a lot of this is pure golden optimism, which I'd love to share.
Yeah, both of you, to some extent, this is all of our second plague in some way. Bet, your career started to take off by performing at the Continental Baths and had a big gay following, still do.
And
Paul, you've written about AIDS quite a number of times, and you've approached it both in a satirical way and in a very serious way at the same time. And now we're living through COVID. How does the AIDS period at all relate to, not that it's over, but how does the height of the AIDS period relate to what we're experiencing now, the tragedy that we're experiencing now, in any way?
I mean, I would say that the primary similarity involves the government response or lack of response. That especially in those early months when Trump called it a Democratic hoax, when he refused to have anything to do with it. There's also a sense of marginalizing the sick, that because COVID has attacked especially communities of color, the elderly, that they don't count, that those lives are expendable. So there's a real similarity there. On the other hand, there are vast differences because AIDS was something that was attacking such, especially in the early days, such a specific community that was already considered wildly expendable. And it was, in its own sense, even scarier because it was far more fatal and because it was so unknown. I think also partially because of the AIDS crisis, there was a certain familiarity, especially in the bridge of Dr. Fauci, that he is someone who eventually behaved beautifully during the AIDS crisis and became friends with Larry Kramer, which is almost impossible. And he's become a beacon of decency and truth now, too. So there is a sense, I think, that he learned, there was a learning curve for him and the rest of us then about, okay, this is how you cope with this.
Bet, would you like to do Coastal Elites as originally planned in the theater?
I think this is the best way. I think it was, in a funny way, it was serendipity. It was serendipitous that this technology, the Zoom technology, was available at this time during this pandemic, that he had a piece that was, it was all solo monologues anyway. It works perfectly within this framework. It was as if there was no thought. It was almost as if it was written for this time, really, truly. And I will tell you that at my stage of life, 8 shows a week is like, oh, please.
Bette Midler, Paul Rudnick, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Bye.
Bette Midler is one of the stars of Paul Rudnick's Coastal Elites, along with Caitlin Deaver, Dan Levy, Sarah Paulson, and Issa Rae. It's out on HBO this month, but if you can't wait a few days, you can read a lot of terrific work by Paul Rudnick at NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
What did he say?
He said he found out where her family came from. He wanted me to come home so I could go there with him.
He's still obsessing over her ancestry. I thought he'd given all that up when she passed.
I know that, like your mother, you think that you can forget the past. He can't. The past is a living thing. You own it, owe it. Now, I have found something about your mother's forebears. You have a sacred secret legacy, a birthright that's been kept from you.
That's strange. That don't really even sound like your father.
I haven't even gotten to the strange part. The place he wants me to go with him is in Lovecraft country.
The new show, Lovecraft Country, is not exactly about the writer H.P. Lovecraft, but it's set in the kind of fictional world that Lovecraft pioneered, a world of horror and fantastical beings and ancient evil. Lovecraft died in 1937, but is getting a lot of attention in 2020. In addition to this new show that bears his name, the science fiction writer N.K. Jemisin published a book this year that's very much a response to H.P. Lovecraft. It's called The City We Became. On a very windy day last winter, N.K. Jemisin met up with staff writer Rafi Khachdourian on the pedestrian walkway of the Williamsburg Bridge because The City We Became has a key scene that takes place there.
So, Nora, in the opening of your book, you have set upon this bridge a giant, tentacled, bioluminescent, interdimensional creature to tear it apart.
Basically, yeah. Well, I mean, no one can see it except for a few select individuals for reasons that will become clear in the book. But, you know, it just sort of is a giant tentacle that smashes out of nowhere, shatters half the bridge, causes massive destruction and damage all over the East River. And no one really knows why except for a few people. But what it means is that half this beautiful old bridge gets torn apart and smashed into the water, and I laughed while I did it.
We ducked into a bar on the Brooklyn side of the bridge to talk out of the wind.
This is so nice. You got a place opened up just for us.
Science fiction is transporting. It's whimsical. It can go in many different directions. It can be apocalyptic. To say that you were interested in science fiction opens up the question, what kind as a kid interested you, and in which of these directions did you feel yourself being pulled as a reader?
I really didn't start to engage with science fiction until I kind of hit my teens and started to find different voices out there. Octavia Butler, Ursula Le Guin, stories that also ranged beyond the very traditional confines that I had seen for fantasy and science fiction at that point. And I wanted to kind of know what else fantasy could do. And then along comes Le Guin, who was doing it before it was cool.
You mentioned that it took a while to find some of these other authors. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that wasn't accidental. Because science fiction publishing in the when you were a reader as a kid in the 80s almost went out of its way to mask the identity of writers of color. Octavia Butler's Dawn is an example of a book that we both owned.
The protagonist is described in the book as a tall, very dark-skinned black woman with like a cloud of hair. And I don't think Butler ever actually uses the word black, but there's so many other indicators in there. And then the edition put a white woman with black hair on the cover. And there were no author photos of Butler. There was no mention in her bio in that edition that she was black. It really was like hidden. And yet, despite all the attempts to hide it, I realized basically within the first few pages, oh my God, I think she's black. And that was just like earth-shattering.
Mm-hmm. This cultural invisibility that the system of publishing engendered had a personal impact on you, because when you were, as I understand it, growing up and thinking about considering possible careers for yourself,
I didn't initially consider writing.
You didn't consider writing. You didn't think it would be possible to make it work.
I mean, and that was coming from a lot of different directions. I don't want to make it sound like it was coming strictly from within the industry. You know, I can remember having conversations with relatives other than my father about the fact that I love to write, and, you know, them then handing me a Toni Morrison book and saying, do you write like this? And when I said no, you know, the response was always, well, you need to write like this. You need to write realist, mainstream-oriented fiction that will, you know, kind of focus on life in America today as a black person or oppression or something like that. And I was just like, but I want to write about black people in space. And for a lot of times when I would say that, the response would be, well, you can't.
And why in the black community do you think that was the case?
Well, I mean, it is the nature of any group of people that you understand you are capable of what you see. Role models operate on lots of levels. If you never see a black person in a particular space, then you get the really clear message that you're not welcome in that space. And so I got that message loud and clear when I was young. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to be a counselor. I'm going to grad school for psychology. The writing is a fun hobby, but it's clear that that field is not one that I can be successful in without, a lot of trouble and drama and stress. And I don't know that I want that in my life. And then, basically I hit a point where I realized I was just not happy. You know, the writing bug had been in me since I was a child. I'd always done it. I'd read many books that had been published that I felt, I can do that. I can do at least that good. And, I hit a point where I decided that it was worth the danger or worth the trouble and the stress and the drama. And it sure has been some trouble and stress and drama. But the rewards have been commensurate.
When Jemison talks about the trouble and the stress and the drama, she's partly referring to a backlash from conservative science fiction writers and readers, among them people associated with the alt-right. They claim, and this will sound familiar, that the success of non-white authors and women in science fiction has somehow been undeserving, a form of identity politics. It's been very, very ugly, and Jemison's new book, The City We Became, addresses the legacy of racism in the genre.
And in fact, the book that's coming out in March mm-hmm. continues to speak to those issues.
In some ways. So one of the inspirations for The City We Became was the controversy surrounding the World Fantasy Award. Until maybe 2 or 3 years ago, the World Fantasy Award was the stylized bust of H.P. Lovecraft's head. And the controversy about this started when a black writer, Nnedi Okorafor, who's a friend of mine, Nnedi won the World Fantasy Award and they handed her Lovecraft's head and she was like, you can find her words online about it. She did, she most definitely pointed out that Lovecraft is an inappropriate way to honor a black writer's success, let's just say.
Nora, who is H.P. Lovecraft?
Okay, so Lovecraft is probably one of the most seminal writers in American modern fantasy. You know, he wrote at the turn of the century, but a lot of the ways in which American fantasy and American horror engages with subcultures, cults, religion, and so forth were all influenced by Lovecraft. So you saw, sort of sinister cults that had taken over towns, and there's echoes of that in The Stepford Wives, for example. You saw tentacled monsters that sort of didn't come at you roaring or screaming, but sort of slithered into your life and integrated themselves into your community and then slowly destroyed you from within. You see aspects of that in things like Aliens, in the Alien films. Lovecraft may not be very well known, but you see elements of Lovecraft in nearly all dark, fantastical American media these days. So he's that influential. And he was exceptionally racist. Lovecraft had a poem, and I cannot speak the title because I don't use the N-word, but the title of the poem is On the Creation of N-Words. And his cat was named the N-word. He was like, even by the standards of the racist era in which he lived, he was huge, hella racist.
But and do you think that there is a way to separate whatever his creativity, whatever his skills were at evoking horror from his fear, his biases?
No, his biases were the basis of his horror. The monsters came from his own fear mm-hmm. of brown people, of immigrants, of Jewish people, of whatever. In several of his stories, particularly one set in New York, Lovecraft spends a lot of time, sort of lavishes description on how terrifying it is to do something like walk through Chinatown and look at these alien, frightening faces speaking in this terrible language. And you feel his fear as you read these passages. You feel his disgust. You feel his unease at being surrounded by people who don't look like him. There's a scene in The City We Became in which the minions of the woman in white...
The woman in white being the chief manifestation of these aliens that come to invade New York City.
Yeah,
and in effect, the embodiment of the Lovecraftian enemy, let's say, that the protagonists are taking on.
Yeah, the antagonist of the story. The woman in white has many forms and many faces. And one of the ways through which she works is through like-minded people who she infects with her ideology, literally in some ways, some cases. And so she infects a group of artists who call themselves the alt-artists, mm-hmm. And who present to one of the characters this painting called Dangerous Mental Machines. And the painting...
You didn't make up the title of that painting. That's something that comes from Lovecraft.
Yeah, Dangerous Mental Machines is what he called Chinese Americans because he believed that Asian people were equivalent to white people because they at least knew how to work and make money. But he didn't think that they had souls. He thought that they were machines that were good at calculation, but there was no humanity in there.
And Nora, I remember this passage of the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's vivid in my mind because you describe the painting as both being incredibly seductive, mm-hmm. of it being beautiful. In fact, one of the chief protagonists almost falls into a trance, mm-hmm. while looking at it.
It's good art.
It's good art, even though it has this undeniably horrific component to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's you know, I mean, I'm not good at sort of analyzing my own work, but with Lovecraft, the balance and the struggle is always between appreciating the fact that there's some good stuff here. He does some incredible imagery. It's powerful work, but it's frightening. And it's frightening not always for the reasons that he meant it to be frightening. It's frightening because it's a way to look into the mind of a true bigot and realize just how alien their thinking is, just how disturbing their ability to dehumanize their fellow human beings is. This man literally saw the people of New York as monsters. So that's what I decided to write against.
And so what do you think, as a society or community of readers, the response to Lovecraft should be today?
To
put it in a box and send it down to the bottom of the sea?
There's too much to learn from examining that tension between the power and the impact of the art and realizing where that art comes from and what the impetus behind that art is. The best way to engage with twisted or otherwise problematic art, in my opinion, is to first off acknowledge that art has an impact, hurts people, and understand that engaging with it could perpetuate some of the harm that art is capable of doing. But flag it, warn it, put it off to the side where people, you know, can engage with it at their leisure or at their choice or at a point where they're strong enough or capable of doing so, but then engage with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a line between respecting the work and honoring the person. You can respect the craft. You don't have to put that person on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. You know, artists are human beings, and that means you need to examine them in all their facets. You have to recognize that these are people and that the things that make them sometimes horrible people are sometimes the things that make them good writers or good artists. And that's what you want to engage with.
N.K. Jemisin, author of The City We Became, and also of the Broken Earth trilogy, which received 3 Hugo Awards. She talked early this year with staff writer Rafi Khachdourian. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As summer draws to an end and schools attempt to reopen, it's becoming very clear that pandemic restrictions will extend through the fall and perhaps well into next year. And the prospect of that is daunting for everybody, not least for anyone with kids in the house. After months without summer camps or team sports or scouting trips, the idea of keeping kids indoors seems like more than a parent could bear. But it's happened before, and not that long ago.
I'm Jill Lepore. I'm a professor of history at Harvard. I'm also a staff writer at The New Yorker. And as a historian, I always think a lot about, well, is there comfort to be found in times in the past when people have had harder struggles and gotten through things? And immediately comes to mind for me the stay-at-home campaigns that were run during the polio years.
For all the boys and girls of the Northwest during radio's stay-at-home campaign. Now, listen.
Polio had first hit the U.S. in 1916, and some years were worse than others. A lot of viruses abate in the hotter months. But with polio, the warmer the weather, the virus spread faster, but also polio was most effectively transmitted by water. So in the summer when it got hot, this is before the age of air conditioning, kids would be outside wanting to go to swimming pools, jump in the river. And it's not like they have homeschooling assignments. It's the summer. Like they're supposed to be outside playing catch and playing baseball and drawing hopscotch with chalk on the sidewalk. And it was really hard to keep them inside. And there was, I came across this incredibly charming clip from WCCO in Minneapolis, which had a Sunday morning program called Fun at Home during the stay-at-home campaign.
Well, it's 9:05 and time for all you kids to gather around your radios and listen to the funnies. This morning we have an extra.
And they would do anything to be entertaining to kids. So this clip is from 1946, and it's the fairly young Democratic mayor, Hubert Humphrey. I mean, think of him maybe as the Andrew Cuomo of the moment, although more charming. He comes in, volunteers to come into the radio station on Sunday to read the funnies out loud.
We start right off with Blondie, and you know what? It looks like Blondie and Dagwood are going to go out on a fishing party. Toby, you got any fishing music over there?
Yeah, a little bit by the sea.
Yeah, that's good. That's fine. Oh, listen to that. Now, just take a look at that. There's Dagwood, kids, and there's Dagwood right along. There's he right alongside the lake shore there, and he says, I don't know why it is I can't catch a fish. Doesn't he look, he just looks all down in the dumps, you know?
So, and he loves it. I mean, you can tell because he brings his kids with him. Like, he does voices and he tries to be Dagwood and Blondie. And his kids keep asking questions and they want him to read Popeye instead.
A can of worms there, and look at that funny hat on there, just like he's hunting lions. You see that, Skip? And he says,
I have one of them too.
Oh, you have a hat like that. And then Dagwood says, they pull out fish as fast as they
can. And when I first listened to this clip, maybe in the fall sometime, I was like, this, it's so adorable and it's so sweet and it's so quaint. But somehow the pathos of it didn't strike me.
Chocolate eclairs for bait. He just uses everything, but he can't catch anything. So there he goes.
One of the strange, maybe only blessings of the COVID pandemic is that kids seem to be so far less vulnerable to it. But with polio, it's exactly the opposite. For a long time, polio was called the baby plague, which is this heartbreaking name, just to think about that. What it does to know that your children, babies, toddlers, preschoolers, are the most vulnerable.
Fishing on private property, huh? Without a license, huh?
Is that a policeman?
Oh, that's a policeman, you betcha. Without
and
a license.
And a long nose.
Oh, he got a long nose, yeah. I wonder who that... That's a funny-looking guy, all right.
Like, I just... It didn't really hit me that this was a desperate measure. It just seemed to me adorable. And I listened to it again. I almost listened to Hubert Humphrey with what I think of as COVID ears. And it's still sweet. It's still charming. I still love listening to it. But it's also quietly desperate.
Mayor Humphrey, we're going to have a song by Toby Prince, the original sad sack song. Toby, take over with Put Your Arms Around Me. Cuddle up a little closer. Lovey, lovey mine.
One of the reasons I study history is I like to see how things began so that I can imagine how bad things end. So there were good polio years and bad polio years, but the worst polio year in the United States was 1952. So a few years after Hubert Humphrey made that recording, reading the funnies, 58,000 Americans got infected. And it was also the year, though, that a young epidemiologist named Jonas Salk developed a vaccine.
A virus that causes polio has been successfully grown inside chicken eggs. This may lead to the development of a potent vaccine to prevent the dreaded disease.
A really promising vaccine, a really controversial vaccine, and it had to be tested. And then he began what became the largest field trial in the history of public health.
Even so, it was the largest such medical test ever attempted.
And finally, on this momentous day, April 12th, 1955, the beginning of spring.
Heading the medical men was Dr. Jonas Salk.
Summer's coming. It's going to be another hard polio year. People expected it to be a very hard polio year. The clock is ticking. The calendar is turning. Everybody wants that polio vaccine before the summer of 1955. And there's this quite incredible announcement it's made at the University of Michigan. Hundreds of reporters go there, and they printed out these press reports with all the details of the results of the field trial that they're going to announce.
Reporters pressed forward to get the results the whole world was waiting for. Rushed to their typewriters.
And the reporters are literally climbing over each other, trying to get to the copies of the press release, like so eager. I mean, you can imagine that now. It doesn't take a whole lot of imagining to imagine that now. If someone had a vaccine and we'd waited 18 months to know if it worked. And it works.
An historic victory over a dread disease is dramatically unfolded at the University of Michigan. Here, scientists usher in a new medical age with the monumental report.
I mean, just, you picture sort of a medieval turreted castle and the trumpeteers blowing their horns and the flags are, you know, the standards are being unfurled and like there's just this, like, the vaccine works, and you know, this kind of, and it's the relief, the joy, the exaltation, the exhilaration, the knowledge that this thing could end.
90% effective, and modest Dr. Salk answers newsmen's questions.
The great wealth of events that has accumulated in the experiences of so many is well represented in the report made this morning.
We often notice that people from different generations have these different timestamps in their early memories. Like, there are people whose first memory is of 1969 and watching the Apollo moon landing, or whose first memory is of 1963 and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I remember for years when I would ask students what their first memory was of an event of global significance, it was 9/11. I grew up with the vaccine, but people not very much older than I am suffered from polio, watched polio, knew people who suffered from polio. But my kids don't know anyone has had polio. I don't think they know how it works or how terrifying it was. And that's the great blessing of a vaccination program, right? Like, we forget how bad the disease was. But there's a generation of Americans whose most significant early memory is of waiting in line to get the Salk vaccine. I have a colleague who I once asked about this, and he said, oh, I can remember the taste of it in my mouth. It was like a sugar drop. It was almost like a lollipop. And my mother said, this will save your life. You will have a life. And I think about that, and I think about the generation of kids who we can only hope will remember the day that they go to get the coronavirus vaccine. And it will be their timestamp.
Staff writer and professor of history, Jill Lepore. Jill's just written about the science of spending most of your life indoors, and you can find it at newyorker.com. This has been a summer of reckoning with our past. Confederate monuments have come down in Charleston, Richmond, Jacksonville, and many other places. Mississippi has removed the stars and bars from its flag at long last. There's just one Confederate monument left on public land in the state of Maryland. It's a statue that honors soldiers who died fighting for the Confederacy. Some were said to have fought against their own neighbors and cousins who served for the Union. But removing that statue has proved to be much more complicated than you might guess. On our program next week, Casey Sepp brings us the story of the Talbot Boys Monument and one small town's struggle over its history. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Lea, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.